Welcome back to Pod Save the World. I'm Tommy Vitor.
I'm Ben Rhodes.
Ben, here is what we're going to cover today. We're going to talk a little bit about some extreme Republican foreign policy ideas. Big news out of Finland, the president of Taiwan's visit to the U.S. and Latin America, some nuke negotiations, the VA, a blogger who got assassinated in Russia, and U.S. journalists who got arrested, Montenegro's new president, OPEC oil cuts, Jared Kushner, King Charles's inauguration, Mussolini's granddaughter. But first, we got to just talk about Trump getting arrested. Just perp walked.
I think we do. I just watched it from France, which was kind of like a funny place
you're
to watch
abroad.
It from.
You're abroad right now. Is Trump all over the news? Are people like spotting you as an American and asking you about it?
So it's kind of interesting. In the UK, I was in the UK before this, it was everywhere, right? It was in Scotland, the cab drivers want to talk about it. Here, it's a little more chill, maybe because they got their own stuff going on with these strikes and protests. So definitely traveled. It seemed to travel a little more intensely to our special relationship up there.
Yeah. No. Have you hit the streets? Have you burnt any trash piles?
I have not. There's a general strike apparently on Thursday, so I'll see what happens there.
Yeah. Don't take the train that day. So we're recording this at 1 p.m. Pacific time on April 4th, Tuesday. By the time this comes out tomorrow, I'm sure there'll be lots more information out there about the indictment, what happened behind the scenes, et cetera, the protests. But one thing is clear, Ben, is that Trump is trying to push the narrative that his arrest is somehow an indictment of America itself. He tweeted, "The USA is now a third world nation," in all caps. His idiot sons made the same point. But as we discussed a couple weeks ago with Crooked contributor Max Fisher, that is not the case. So maybe we give you a little data for everybody to help you push back on this nonsense. So this was a helpful story in Axios. Leaders who have left office since 2000 have been jailed or prosecuted in at least 78 countries. That is more than I expected, Ben. 78 is a lot. You see some dictatorships where they're not arresting anybody.
Yeah. I also, what does he mean by third world at this point? Because it's, first of all, it's not the Cold War anymore, and it's just basically a racist comment he's been making for the last 8 years. But honestly, I think people looking at this from outside of America would think less of the United States and our legal system if Trump was allowed to just commit crime after crime after crime and not be prosecuted for it. I don't want to use the third world terminology, but whatever term you want to use for a country that is kind of not evolved and not a democracy, you would think that putting people above the law is more the problem than actually just enforcing the law.
Yeah, again, countries that have prosecuted heads of state include France, Italy, Israel, Brazil, Taiwan, South Korea. The former president of Mexico is being investigated for corruption, but he hasn't been charged yet. Latin America has racked up the most prosecutions. Apparently, every president of Peru, except one who served between 1985 and 2018, has been arrested or charged. So that's not great. But you're right. I mean, I think far more destabilizing are countries that don't demand accountability. And what turns you into a banana republic is what Bibi Netanyahu is doing over in Israel, where he's trying to cut the judicial system, right?
Totally. There's a North Korean vibe to some of the rhetoric from the Republican Party about Trump. He is our chairman. He is our leader. He is our champion. How could this possibly happen to him? That's the stuff, I think, from other countries. It looks weird. I honestly, having traveled a lot, I'm traveling now, I don't think people in other countries are looking at this and thinking, wow, it's very strange that Donald Trump is being prosecuted. I think they've looked at this for a while and thought, it's very strange that Donald Trump can get away with everything and that he has this kind of cultish following in the Republican Party. That is the accurate, overwhelming majority of global opinion. So whenever they pivot to this talking point, it flies in the face of the reality that, Trump is the thing that people around the world look at and say, that's American decline. That's America becoming whatever you can call it, a banana republic.
Yeah, and second, this is a bummer for us libs over here, but being prosecuted doesn't mean your career is over. Lula da Silva spent 580 days in jail and was just elected president again. And then in Italy, former Prime Minister Silvio Berlusconi made a comeback after being convicted of tax fraud. But Ben, people shouldn't just take our word for it. We wanted to play a quick clip from an actual expert, a real historian who's steeped in this stuff.
President Trump is joining some of the most incredible people in history being arrested today. Nelson Mandela was arrested, served time in prison. Jesus was arrested and murdered by the Roman government. There have been many people throughout history that have been arrested and persecuted by radical, corrupt governments. And it's beginning today in New York City. And I just can't believe it's happening, but I'll always support him. He's done nothing wrong.
That was Congresswoman Marjorie Taylor Greene setting us straight.
Yeah, like those radical leftists and the apartheid regime and that radical Pontius Pilate, you know.
Favre said Pontius Pilate was a Soros-backed judge. I didn't actually know that.
I mean, like, it's just totally absurd. Like, she is clearly the thing that people around the world look at and think, like, these people have lost their fucking minds.
Yes.
But the other, I have to say, like, looking at the images, it was actually more powerful than I thought it was. I actually have not been able to read all this breathless coverage of this stuff because it was sliding back into the like circa 2018 Trump's mood, and a person familiar with his mood said he's, you know, defiant or something like that. But seeing him in, this is not Nelson Mandela in the dock, right? This is like an overweight, aging criminal, like sitting in the iconic place, right, with the lawyers there and the judge. I did kind of reflect on the fact that, like, everything we talk about on this podcast, everything in American politics, in our own lives, right, Tommy, like, we wouldn't be doing this podcast probably if somehow Donald Trump didn't come along, you know, like, this man has been so central, and there's something powerful about the fact that there's some accountability here, you know, and we can argue about whether or not this is the right case to lead with, but, like, I personally felt pretty, like, I was surprised at how much, I don't know how you felt, like, personally, but, like, you know, it's because as someone who, like, has, as any listener to this podcast knows, like, you know, things I'm proud of, Cuba, Iran, that this guy wrecked, never mind my entire kind of life's work up to that point, he you know, tried to wreck at least, never mind everything I believe in, like, there was something pretty powerful about the fact that this happened, and I have to give it to Bragg, you know, like this guy didn't hesitate. You know, there's no like Hamlet in the Justice Department here. This guy's like, okay, like I've got enough to go. Like, we're going to bring this guy in and arraign him. I kind of loved it, actually.
Yeah, there's been a lot of kind of approaches to thinking about, talking about sort of out of thematic approaches to dealing with Trump that you would see from the media or on Twitter over the past several years. And I think the one that annoyed me the most was the like, LOL, nothing matters take.
Yeah.
Because that was like, oh, you know, his racism doesn't matter. His corruption doesn't matter. Lying doesn't matter. And I think if we just accept all those things to be true, then the worst people in the world are just going to flourish in politics and no one else is going to be able to compete. So I agree with you. Like, there is something cathartic and important and very meaningful to seeing him at least begin this process of accountability.
Yeah. And that picture will be with him, like, you know, the rest of history. Like, and look, I mean, what drives me crazy, and like, you guys have to engage us a lot more on PSA, but like the coverage, it's like, if he doesn't get indicted, he wins. And if he does, he somehow wins too. Like everything is a win for him. Like, no, maybe actually like gravity laws, like, are catching up with this guy. And again, for our purposes, there is deep fear around the world, particularly in this continent of Europe where I am, of his return, you know?
Yeah.
We are not going to be out of the woods in terms of even having any hope of restoring American credibility until it's clear that this guy, whether it's at the ballot box or in the judicial system or both, is just not coming back. You know, until that day, like, there's going to be this dark cloud over America. I mean, I'm in France now. Emmanuel Macron is in China, right? He's there as a hedge, you know, against against Donald Trump coming back. You know, these are huge geopolitical things that are tied to whatever happens to this guy.
Yeah. So as long as we're talking about Trump, let's talk about a foreign policy reason why him not returning is so important. This is just sort of like these extreme views that are bubbling up because of Trump. So the first bend is a proposal to bomb Mexican cartels with or without the Mexican government's permission to stop the flow of fentanyl into the United States. Fentanyl, as listeners probably know, is this incredibly potent synthetic opioid. It's responsible for most overdose deaths in the United States. It's an absolute scourge. We have to get rid of it. But Trump used to muse about bombing Mexico in private back in the day. I remember Mark Esper, as Secretary of Defense, kind of leaked that he would do this. But now Rolling Stone is reporting that Trump has asked advisors to draw up battle plans and military options for his second term. But he's not alone here. Republican members of Congress, including Dan Crenshaw, have put forward bills authorizing military force. Lindsey Graham is flirting with the idea of introducing an authorization for the use of military force to target cartels. And the point is basically they're trying to treat cartels and drug importation into the U.S. like terrorism and attack these people with or without support from the Mexican government. And it's becoming this mainstream idea. In fact, James Comer, the House Oversight Chairman, actually criticized Trump for not bombing Mexico during his first term. So, like, in case it needs to be said, just a couple reasons why this is not a good idea. One, the U.S. spent years trying to bomb drug dealers into submission in Afghanistan, and we failed miserably at it. Two, invading Mexico probably wouldn't go over very well in, like, Mexico. So, Ben, a couple weeks ago, we talked about how AMLO, the president of Mexico, blamed U.S. fentanyl deaths on this weird stuff. He talked about, like, a lack of hugs among Americans and the treatment of the elderly and all this weird shit. I suspect that this loose talk about, like, us invading his country maybe has made him sensitive about the subject in general. But I also don't really get why he wouldn't want to be helpful to Biden when one party is threatening to invade his country and the other isn't. But I don't know. Any deep thoughts on bombing cartels? Good idea?
I just think, like, you're right to point out that this is not like an impossible thing. Like, it's a thing that might happen. Because if, like, this is where the Republican Party is going and Donald Trump is still like the front man of the Republican Party and he is like clearly capable of doing insane shit and wanted to do this by all reports, or at least mused about doing it. It's worth just pointing out the insanity of this beyond your point that it won't solve the problem at all. It's also the case that the militarization of the war against the cartels hasn't worked to begin with. It needs a more multifaceted approach here.
The Mexican military has been targeting them for decades.
Yeah, and it's been really, this thing has been, it really kicked up in the Bush years, and it just hasn't solved this problem, right? And it just shows you the Republicans aren't interested in solving this problem. I would also say, though, like, just the discussion of it, right? We're the biggest thing in American foreign policy right now is trying to get as many countries together around the basic idea that a big country shouldn't be able to invade its neighbor against international law. Like in Ukraine, right? And so if like the Republican Party's platform is essentially, we don't want to support Ukraine anymore. Like, we're going to end support for the Ukrainians because that's where Trump is. That's where DeSantis is. But we do want to invade our neighbor just like Russia did. It just shows you the complete bankruptcy and insanity of this political party and its incapacity to like think responsibly about these things. Never mind that this would not only be illegal, but I can't imagine what the response would be across Latin America, around the world. Like, this is just an insane, batshit crazy idea, but it's one that we're probably going to hear more about.
Can you imagine being just sort of your average family in Mexico? You wake up, you make some pancakes for the kids, you flip open the paper, and it's like, Trump wants to invade Mexico to take out cartels. It's insane. This is completely insane.
Yeah, the Mexican-American War 2.0.
Let's not do that again.
Not since Polk.
A quick aside. Here's one reason we might be seeing some extreme foreign policy ideas coming out of the House GOP. The Intercept reported that the legislative aide handling military policy for Matt Gaetz is a convicted war criminal. He is a former Army National Guard sergeant who spent 8 years in prison, wait for it, for shooting an Afghan civilian in the head during an interrogation. This guy is handling military policy and has a security clearance for Matt Gaetz.
Do you think that Gaetz found him or he found Gaetz?
That's a good question. That's a good question.
You do wonder, who's in these offices? All these, nut jobs? Because, would they have access to information? Do they have security clearances? Are they, able to get briefings on stuff? This is the most insane stuff. But again, you can think that this is fringe, but we've talked a lot about Eddie Gallagher, remember? The war criminal that became a hero on the right.
Navy SEAL.
And on Fox News. Yeah, the Navy SEAL who was shooting dead bodies and allegations of horrible stuff that came from his unit, his SEALs. It just shows you like how grotesque. There is a gateway drug thing to this too, where like first they were like into Gitmo, like they were defending that. That was so great. And, you know, then they're defending waterboarding. And now they literally have war criminals working for them. That's where this stuff leads, you know?
Yeah. Whew, crazy stuff. Okay, so let's turn to Finland because we don't get to talk about it enough and there's some big updates. So the first is that Sanna Marin, the 37-year-old prime minister of Finland, lost her bid for re-election. So this is a three-way contest and both the center-right National Coalition Party and the populist Finns Party narrowly beat her Social Democratic Party. When she was elected in 2019, Marin was the world's youngest sitting leader. But it seems like voters have blamed her for Finland's rising debt and inflation. She's also come under criticism for being young and fun and doing things like going to concerts and going to the occasional party, like literally everyone her age. Finland has a parliamentary system, so now the leader of the National Coalition Party will try to form a coalition government and likely become prime minister, but that could take some time. And it's not clear whether this sort of center-right party will try to form a coalition with people, the populace to their right, or with the more progressive, so we'll see. But the second big update is that Finland has officially joined the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, or NATO. This is a huge change for Finland. For decades, they did this delicate dance of maintaining relations with both the West and Russia. They share an 800-mile land border with Russia, so they have a vested interest in not getting into a shooting war with the Russians. But the Russian invasion of Ukraine changed the calculus for Finland. Despite once blaming NATO expansion for the invasion itself, the Russian response has been relatively muted. But of course, that could change if NATO starts moving in, I don't know, big weapon systems or something to Finland. Finland itself has a capable and advanced military. This is a boon for NATO. Sweden has also been trying to join NATO, but their application, is that what it's called? Their process has been held up by Turkey, who is demanding that Sweden extradite members of a militant Kurdish political party to Turkey. So NATO now has 31 member states. They all agree to defend each other against an attack. It's a big deal. It's a big change. Ben, any thoughts on Sanna Marin's defeat or this newly expanded, refurbished, some might say, NATO?
Well, I mean, on Sanna Marin's defeat, congratulations, Finland, on becoming really boring again. Like, I hope you feel good about that. But more seriously, in addition to losing a social democratic voice, which is, you know, we're on the social democratic team here on this podcast, there's something just kind of a little, I was thinking about this, a little depressing about the fact that, like, one of the hopeful trends out there in global politics, in democracies, was the emergence of these younger female social Democrats who were getting elected in a bunch of different places. And now we've seen Jacinda Ardern leave office, not defeated, but leave office, and, you know, in part because she was burned out, right? And though she kind of pushed back a little bit against the idea that the burnout was due to the vitriol that had been directed her way from mm-hmm. anti-vaxxers and right-wingers, like that seemed to play a role. Then we talked about Nicola Sturgeon, again, not a leader, but the leader of the Scottish Nationalist Party, a little older than Jacinda Ardern and Sanna Marin, but once
but
again,
much, her private— like 50-something, right? Yeah, like
not that much. In her private life, you know, when I was in Scotland, like, she was saying that, like, there were these rumors and that, you know, that because she was having lesbian affairs with, like, French diplomats and she wasn't, and, like, that clearly played a role there, too. So, and then Sanna Marin, I don't know that the you know, party gate and all this stuff played a role in her defeat. It does seem like it was a lot to do with inflation and government spending and kind of demagoguing things that she probably didn't control, right? Like, there's inflation everywhere. But I do worry about a trend, like, of these female leaders getting more shit than male counterparts. And, you know, I hope that she stays in politics. I hope that she continues to be like someone who is at the front of a trend where there are other people in their 30s and early 40s, women, progressives getting elected. On the NATO piece, look, anything that doubles Russia's land border with NATO is a really big deal. Yeah. And it shows you how profound the impact is of the war. We've talked about this, but essentially if Finland could go through all of the Cold War and then all of the post-Cold War period and 9/11, not in NATO. This is the thing that got them there. Very capable military. Like if Barack Obama was welcoming the Finnish prime minister, he'd say they punch above their weight. You know,
oh yeah.
Generally what he said for the Nordic countries, but it's
love
true.
That line.
And the new Finnish government will have to make a decision about whether to house NATO troops on their country. I do think stepping back, like for listeners making sense of all this stuff and all these pieces moving around the geopolitical board, I think what we can say a year into this war is that the West, the democracies of the world, have kind of reconstituted themselves, reconsolidated their alliances, reinvested in NATO. At the same time that, as we've talked about, like Russia, China, Iran, this other group of countries has deepened their ties. And this is like the, you know, I think the foremost signal of that, that essentially we have seen a kind of revitalization, but it has been limited within the borders of what we would have once called the free world, you know?
Yeah.
And this is kind of, this is drawing that boundary, literally. Like the 800 miles that just became a border between NATO and Russia with Finland's accession, you know, does say like, okay, the line is drawn and we're revitalizing democratic institutions and values and common defense over here, but we know that the other team is doing that as well.
Hi, I'm Alex Wagner. I do not need to tell you that being an American right now is a wild ride. But as a longtime journalist, I am not interested in the noise or the fear-mongering. I'm interested in the stories at the heart of the headlines. That is why every week on my show, Runaway Country, I'm joined by folks in the middle of the crossfire. From disillusioned MAHA moms to newly fired immigration judges to Epstein victims themselves, to understand what it means to live through this political chaos as an actual human being. And now I'm excited to tell you that Runaway Country is available ad-free to Friends of the Pod subscribers. Friends of the Pod is the subscription that supports the work Crooked does as an independent media company and gives you a ton of great bonus and ad-free content. With the midterms approaching, you are going to need more content to keep you sane. And now you can find Runaway Country right there. Subscribe now at crooked.com/friends.
So speaking of the front lines of democracy, we should talk about Taiwan. Because Taiwan's president, Tsai Ing-wen, is visiting the U.S. this week. She's stopping in California after visiting Guatemala and Belize. We should start with that Latin America piece of the trip, because it comes shortly after Honduras broke off diplomatic relations with Taiwan. Taiwan's relationship with Honduras had dated back to the 1940s. It was sort of a Cold War, anti-communist relationship. But today, Honduras is deep in debt. And they reportedly demanded billions of dollars in assistance from the Taiwanese government before breaking off ties and establishing relations with China. President Tsai's visit was designed to firm up relations with Guatemala and Belize and prevent more of Taiwan's 13 remaining diplomatic allies from cutting ties with them. Since 2017, Panama, El Salvador, the Dominican Republic, and Nicaragua have all cut ties with Taiwan, so this is a scary trend for them. President Tsai will meet with House Speaker Kevin McCarthy at the Ronald Reagan Presidential Library in California, near LA, actually. She met with Congressman Hakeem Jeffries last week in New York City. Basically, she flew to New York, flew to Latin America, then flew back through California. We'll go back to Taiwan. The Chinese government is very pissed off about the meeting with Kevin McCarthy and has warned McCarthy not to repeat disastrous past mistakes, is their quote. Remember that they flipped out about Nancy Pelosi's visit to Taiwan in 2022. So, Ben, I would love to hear your thoughts on this visit to Belize and Guatemala and the value of, you know, sort of keeping together Taiwan's 13 remaining diplomatic allies, even if we're talking about, in many cases, very small countries that, you know, couldn't do much to push back on China, as well as this planned meeting with Kevin McCarthy. I think, you know, when Pelosi went to Taiwan, I think you and I both were kind of like, you know, is the juice worth the squeeze here? I mean, this is creating so much angst. There was this like massive military response from the Chinese government for months and months and months afterwards. But the Chinese government telling Kevin McCarthy who to meet with in the United States seems like a whole other bridge further and pretty unprecedented and absurd to me. But I don't know. What do you think?
On the visit to Central America, I mean, you know, if you go to Taiwan, like when I was there, like they these allies and the, you know, these friends that they have, the countries that have diplomatic relations, are very important to them psychologically. Like, you know, you go into their foreign ministry, the flags are up on the wall. And it's basically Pacific Island countries and some countries in the Americas. As someone who's very sympathetic to Taiwan, I just don't think that this is going to last, you know, in the sense that the Chinese have so many cards to play to pressure these countries to shift to not having relations with Taiwan. I actually think if I was Taiwan, if I was advising the Taiwanese, I would focus more on, can we build more connectivity with, you know, European countries, with other democracies around the world in different ways, right? Can we have, and yes, ideally you'd want some diplomatic relationship, right? You'd want, like, Lithuania recently opened, the Taiwanese opened an office in Lithuania. I think the Lithuanians are doing the same in Taiwan. Like, rather than kind of try to hang, this is a game China is going to win because they just have a lot more cards to play. So rather than try to hang on to these small countries.
The Marshall Islands, Palau. Yeah,
exactly. And the price keeps going up for the Taiwanese. Like, as you said, like, I would focus more on just, can we not make that the measure of our own success and the measure of whether or not we're isolated in the world? And can we have, like, deeper, stronger, more multifaceted relationships with the world's democracies generally, whether or not they kind of formally recognize us in the same way that these countries have? With the McCarthy thing, like, I think it's interesting. I had thought McCarthy would go because I didn't think he would settle for less than what Nancy Pelosi did. So it's clearly, like, the case that he was told probably by a mixture of the Biden White House and some other Republicans, hey, like, this isn't worth you going and kind of, you know, setting off another massive Chinese military exercise.
Can I say, for the first time ever, a credit to him in my book, if he listened to that and thought, okay, well, this is a, like, now I'm in a more senior role, this is kind of the more prudent thing. Like, I don't know. Like, no, he worried less about, like, looking less tough than Nancy Pelosi than doing something that would create fewer problems.
Yeah, I mean, I was wrong. I thought he would go for sure. Maybe he still might. I mean, he's got another year and a half to go.
True.
But, like, you had, because, you know, Mike Pompeo went over there despite having been Secretary of State and presumably knowing, like, how dangerous this was, and demanded that the U.S. recognize Taiwan's independence, which is, like, the one thing that could trigger a war, right? So it's interesting. Whatever play was, clearly the Taiwanese got together with the U.S. government in Congress and agreed on this kind of careful choreography where Tsai Ing-wen gets something, right? Like, Taiwanese presidents don't usually transit the United States like this. And she's meeting the Republican Democratic leader. So it's not like she's losing face. She's doing this trip, but it's slightly less provocative to the Chinese. Now, what we'll have to see is what the Chinese reaction will be, because they'll do something. After Pelosi's visit, their military exercises were so, like, they were firing missiles over Taiwan. They were flying missiles into, like, Japanese waters. They were doing exercises that were basically meant to eliminate what's called the median line, the Taiwan Strait, the body of water that separates Taiwan from mainland China, the People's Republic of China. Like, you know, halfway through that, that body of water is usually, you know, used to be, like, on this side is Taiwanese and this side is Chinese. The Chinese were just trying to, like, totally eliminate that with their exercises. So if they do another kind of massive military exercise with missiles, with ships and air assets that are aiming to kind of eliminate the idea that Taiwan has its own airspace and waters, you know, that's part of, like, their military strategy is of just eating away Taiwanese, like, sovereignty and kind of rehearsing invasions. So if they do that, well, that's a big deal. If they don't, it does show that maybe there's some de-escalation happening here. Maybe everybody's kind of taking it down a notch, you know, after the eventful year that we had.
That would be good. Speaking of situations that we all could love to see get taken down a notch, Axios reported that the U.S., a European, and Israeli diplomats are discussing what has been called a freeze-for-freeze approach to Iran's nuclear program. That basically means the West gives Iran some sanctions relief in exchange for Iran freezing parts of its nuclear program. This comes as Iran has made enormous progress towards getting a bomb since Trump pulled out of the Iran nuclear agreement in 2018. Part of that bomb-making process involves enriching uranium. You use these centrifuges to enrich uranium. You need to get uranium to 90% purity to use it as a nuclear weapon. And currently, Iran has nearly 90 kilograms of 60% enriched uranium, which gets you a long way towards weapons-grade material. So Israel has reportedly said they will bomb Iranian nuclear sites if Iran enriches it past 60%, it's a big stockpile. Axios says that so far Iran is not into this freeze for freeze approach. But Ben, I mean, I guess I was surprised and excited to read this because it felt like diplomacy had just been off the table for a while. But I'm also a little bit confused about whether the Israelis are on board. And if so, how Netanyahu is so intensely opposed to the JCPOA, the Iran nuclear deal from 2015, but in favor of this proposal, which is sort of similar in a lot of ways. Like, what did you make of this leak?
This just is insane to me. I mean, it's the right thing. I'm glad that if this were to happen, it would be a good thing. It wouldn't, you know, do as much as the Iran nuclear deal to roll back Iran's program, but it would kind of stop the clock and like prevent this from being like a flashpoint that could lead to war in the next few months or a couple years. What's so crazy about this, Tommy, is that in 2013, the pathway to the Iran nuclear deal was a freeze for freeze. So this is like literally 10 years ago, we negotiated this, a freeze for freeze. It was opening the doorway to this bigger deal. Netanyahu opposed that freeze for freeze at that time. So to me, the fact that this is where we are in 2023 kind of highlights the insanity of just not being in this bigger deal in the first place. If, you know, if you're willing to do this kind of deal, why not just have the whole thing? Again, I would say, obviously, Trump is the one to blame. The guy sitting in the Manhattan courtroom is the reason why this is happening. Like the only reason that these diplomats have to do this and that we're worried about this war is because this idiot who knew nothing about what he was doing overruled his own advisors to pull out. I'm going to say, many good things happening in Biden foreign policy. In Ukraine, we've talked about Africa. This is a huge indictment of them because when they came back in office, the deal was on the table. We don't know for sure that the Iranians would have accepted, but they didn't even really try out of the box to go back to the full nuclear deal. The freeze for freeze was something they could have done when they came in office, but they didn't want to touch this at the beginning. And now this is where they are, you know? So I hope this happens. I'm skeptical. I think, you know, for the Iranians to do this, they'd have to feel a lot of heat. Maybe this thing with the Chinese and the Saudis has got them in the mood to deal and to just kind of get some heat off their back. So this would be good. But nobody looks good about the fact that this is where this all ended up, you know?
Yeah, and I think you'll probably see some activists, some Iranian activists, very frustrated with the suggestion that the West would cut a deal with Iran at this time after all the protests and after the horrific treatment of women and the Mahsa Amini marches and this bizarre poisoning of schoolgirls that we still don't really totally understand. And I understand that, but there still is, I think, a security argument for getting the nuclear issue off the table, especially from a U.S. perspective.
I get that completely, but even like I wouldn't expect any Iranians and activists to feel good about any deal that is with this government that they want to that they see as having no legitimacy for good reasons. I would say that government having a nuclear weapon is bad, you know, and is more likely to entrench them than power. There could be an argument that maybe we want a military conflict because that could be the thing that removes this government. I'm not so sure. I think if there's bombing of Iranian nuclear facilities by the Israelis, maybe that just drives this government to an even more hardline place and they're trying to get nuclear weapons. So I don't think it a freeze for freeze is somehow, yes, it does kind of contribute to this idea that there is a legitimate government there making diplomatic agreements. But the thing that is going to bring down or dramatically change this government over time is the Iranian people demanding change, not, I don't think, Israel bombing nuclear facilities, right? And so for that reason, I think this is worth exploring. I do want to say, Rob Malley has taken a lot of heat, the envoy for the U.S., I think, from those activists. His job is to try to solve this nuclear issue. And by the way, I don't blame Rob for what I was saying before. I think Rob Malley wanted to, without Rob Malley, we probably would have been back in this agreement, at the beginning of the Biden administration. So, not having a nuclear weapon, I think, is good, not just for U.S. security. I think ultimately that's better for the prospect of change. Because look at North Korea. A regime that has nuclear weapons can hang on in a way that regimes that don't. I mean, not to sound like, not the U.S. imposed regime change here. This is not Libya or Iraq either. I'm just saying I wouldn't equate this deal with something that's going to somehow solve their domestic problems.
Yeah. And let's just talk about why it's important to avoid war at all costs. So a few weeks back, we did a special episode on the Iraq War, and we talked about the enormous cost of that war, both in terms of life lost, the reputation of the United States, and then just the dollar amount. And if you look even more holistically, if you combine all of the post-9/11 wars, the Brown University Cost of War Project estimates that the U.S. government has spent over $8 trillion. A big and growing chunk of that spending is the Department of Veterans Affairs budget. So the VA budget was $45 billion in 2001 and more than $300 billion this year. That is in part because better technology, better medicine meant there were fewer casualties in Iraq and Afghanistan, but you had much higher disability rates for Iraq and Afghanistan veterans because they could survive these horrific blasts and horrific wounds, but needed a lot of care afterwards. So here is what pissed me off. The Washington Post editorial board wrote a piece where they called for changes in how the VA determines whether a veteran gets disability payments to account for a shift from the old way they sort of figured out your disability by deciding whether or not you could do manual labor jobs. And now the Washington Post wants the VA to account for the fact that there's basically desk jobs in the world, right? And then they also called for the VA to means test disability payments so that high earner veterans don't get them. Here's how this editorial ends, Bed. Quote, "But the moral responsibility Americans have to those who fought for the country is of diminished value if it does not align with the fiscal responsibility Americans have to keep their financial house safe and sound." Just quick reason why I think that's one of the dumbest things I've ever read. One, the Washington Post ran 27 editorials in favor of the Iraq War before the invasion, and the editorial board itself was a very loud, very vocal proponent of the war. Two, a former Washington Post reporter named Howie Kurtz, who's now at Fox and lost his mind, said that between August 2002 until the invasion in March, there were approximately 140 front page pieces in the Post making the Bush administration's case for war. That detail came from a great Huffington Post story on this. And then, as the VFW noted, none of the 10 editorial board members of the Post have served in the military, so this wouldn't impact them at all. So, of course, they can opine on military affairs, they can talk about budgets, all this stuff if they want, but it's insane to me that an editorial like this doesn't include any self-awareness about their role in supporting the war. It doesn't include any contrition about completely failing to anticipate the cost of war, right? Remember, we talked about in the Iraq episode how the Bush administration said it would cost like $40 to $50 billion. They were, you know, a couple trillion off. And then just to say like we should balance the budget on the back of veterans who have disabilities is like, honestly, I'm trying to figure out how this piece was written and became alive into the world, how they could actually publish this.
You flagged this for me, and I read the, at first when you flagged it, I was like, oh no, like who's going after these veterans benefits? And I assumed when you sent the clip that it was like a Washington Post news story. And I read it, and I had the same reaction. Like I had to read it a couple of times because, I'm having to control my like emotion. Like I was so angry. like it's hard to explain again to people who might not follow this as closely as we do. No editorial board in the country, not the Wall Street Journal. Like these guys weren't just on board with the war in Iraq, the Washington Post. They could not have been more all in.
So
every single chip they had, every shred of credibility they had, pushed in the middle. They never held themselves accountable for it. After the war, it was always more troops, more troops. If you wanted to pull out any troops, you were a pussy. You were like anti-American.
Yeah,
you
cut didn't and run. Care.
You cut and run. These people, like, which I know is surprising people because the Washington Post is generally thought of as, you know, friendlier to Democrats. Like, not on this issue. Like, these people never owned up to their responsibility for the Iraq War. And they were responsible for the Iraq War. They were the lead editorial page in the nation's capital, making the Bush administration's case more aggressively than the Bush administration at times.
Truly,
right?
Truly.
And then these people, I agree with a lot of things they say about democracy, never wrestle with the fact that their support for democracy around the world was profoundly, profoundly undermined by the Iraq War, by the policies they supported. And for them to have the gall, the nerve, to advocate taking away veterans' benefits, because the only thing that they've also cared about as much as supporting war in Iraq is like a Simpson-Bowles, like overstated hyperbolic concern about deficit. Like, I'm just, I can't even talk about it because it's so without getting angry, because it's so divorced from reality. They should. I hope that the editorial board should have to go to military bases, should have to go to veterans communities. They should have to go to Veterans Affairs hospitals in this country and look those people in the eye and tell them that they supported sending them to Iraq for no reason, and now they support taking away their benefits. This is so offensive.
Now they're like, hey, yeah, I know you lost a leg, but what if you just, you know, sat at a desk all day? Would that bother you? You're not disabled. Are you kidding me?
How about this? Me, Mr. Washington Post editorial writer, like, first I supported sending you to Iraq for false premises, and now I'm going to ask you to sacrifice. I asked you to sacrifice in Iraq, and I'm going to have to ask you to sacrifice on the altar of Washington's fiscal discipline, like, talking points. Give me a break.
It's just
sorry.
Truly,
look, it just pisses me off.
It's truly outrageous. I couldn't believe it when I read it.
Hi, my name is Mitch Landrieu.
My name is Erin Haynes.
My name is Jennifer Palmieri, and we're hosting a new series called Long Play. The South is the new political epicenter of the country. Democrats are way on their heels in this region, but Republicans are going through their own reckoning in the South, too.
I mean, the South has always shaped American politics. We know that.
The stakes could not be higher, but to win the South, you have to understand it.
People in the South feel really misunderstood, left behind, put down on, and they want to explain that to somebody.
We're traveling across six southern states to explore the people, the issues, the assumptions that no longer hold, and what the rest of us are missing about a region that will shape the future of our politics and our country. From Left, Right, and Crooked Media, starting July 27th, watch Long Play Series on YouTube at youtube.com/longplayseries or listen wherever you get your podcasts.
Okay. Talk about the other war that's happening right now, sort of a roundup of news out of Ukraine and Russia. So first, just let's focus on Russia, Ben, because a couple weird stories. First, a pro-war Russian blogger was killed in an explosion in St. Petersburg, Russia on Sunday night. This guy's name is Vladlen Tartarsky. He's giving a public lecture in a cafe that was reportedly owned by Yevgeny Prigozhin, who's the Russian oligarch who controls the Wagner mercenary group. So Tartarsky was handed this small statue that was a likeness of him, apparently, from a woman in the audience shortly before the blast. So the assumption is this thing was like loaded up with explosives. It killed him. It injured dozens more. This guy was one of those right-wing bloggers we've talked about many times on the show. He had a big following on Telegram, this popular social media app in Russia. He was originally from eastern Ukraine, but became super pro-invasion and actually would criticize the Russian military for not being militant enough. And so far, the Russians have blamed Ukraine and they blame supporters of anti-corruption activist Alexei Navalny for this attack. And they arrested a 26-year-old woman. The other thing that happened in Russia last week was the Russian intelligence service, the FSB, arrested a Wall Street Journal reporter named Evan Gershkovich and accused him of spying. Now, I am confident, without knowing Evan, that these charges are complete and total bullshit, and the Russians are just looking for a hostage to get some leverage. But the last time an American reporter was arrested and accused of espionage in Russia was in 1986. So it was the end of the Cold War, when the Moscow bureau chief for U.S. News and World Report was thrown in prison for 13 days. I'm very worried that this current process could stretch on much longer. Since the 70s, we should just note, the CIA has officially prohibited recruiting any U.S. news agency employee because they want to avoid exactly this sort of scenario, either someone being rightly or wrongly accused of being a spy. But Ben, let's pause there because pretty big developments inside Russia for once and not just Ukraine.
I would think that the longer this war goes on, the more you're going to see stuff blowing up or people getting killed in Russia. Again, whether it's some element of the Ukrainian services or whether it's some domestic resistance or oppositionists inside of Russia. And that's a big deal. Like, that's going to bring, I mean, this was right in St. Petersburg, right? This is not like some small, you know, like out in the boondocks here.
It's like a public event.
Yeah, public event. Like, Prigozhin owns the place, right? So, like, that's the first thing. I think this is, I'm more skeptical of the Navalny thing. Like, that's
it seems
nothing.
Weird.
They do like any corruption investigations that they put on YouTube.
Yeah, they
like
make YouTubes.
I don't see that. That's the one thing that feels. And this is not me trying to defend them. It just felt kind of out of character for them. But I'd watch this space, because also if I'm Ukrainians, again, I'm not saying they should be doing this. I'm saying it's human nature that if this war goes on 2, 3, 4 years and Ukrainian kids are getting stolen, like they're going to start doing more of this, like yeah, whether we tell them to or not. Yeah, they're going to want to bring it home to Russia. This is going to happen, no matter what the U.S. government is telling the Ukrainians. I'm not saying they should be doing it. I'm just saying that somebody in Ukraine, whether it's, you know, even if it's not Zelensky ordering it, like there are people that are getting pissed in Ukraine and want to do this.
Yeah,
the journalist thing is really troubling. And to me, just like whether or not Western journalists can stay in Russia is going to be a growing question. If another one, because there's still a bunch of, you know, journalists there. If another person has taken these on clearly trumped up charges, then we have a real problem. And Evan has a real problem. I mean, like espionage charges, this is not like Brittany Griner with the weed charge. Like if they prosecute him for this, they're not going to want to let him go unless there's like a very high level spy swap.
Yeah, spy swap.
So I'd watch that space too. What the things have together is like Russia becoming like a darker place, like, you know, more controlled, more violent. Like Russia is changing too through this war and ways that are kind of scary, you know?
Yeah. And with the you know, arrest of a journalist, you never know if this is a plan coordinated from the top, if some more localized security official, you know, did something very stupid. Unfortunately, the result can kind of be the same, and this could take a very long time to negotiate his release. I think Tony Blinken is demanding his release already. The White House is leaning into this, but it's scary. Some other important updates, Ben. So the U.S. announced another $2.6 billion in military aid for Ukraine. The White House says that Russia is offering North Korea food in exchange for ammunition. A number of news outlets got their hands on this leak of secret files from a private Russian company that is providing cyber warfare and hacking services to the Russian government. If you want to read more about it, Google the Vulcan files. But it's interesting that they, you know, Russia has its own little like WikiLeaks now, reportedly from a disgruntled Russian worker who is angry about the invasion of Ukraine. But, you know, who knows? There could be some intelligence service behind this. And then I saw that there's a Nobel Peace Prize winning Russian journalist named Dmitry Muratov. And he is warning that Russian state propaganda is now laying the groundwork to make people believe that using nuclear weapons is sort of not that big of a deal. That also coincides with this really interesting Washington Post story about the Russians digging massive numbers of deep trenches throughout Crimea and other parts of the occupied Ukrainian territories, which just shows that they're digging in for the long haul for this war.
Yeah. I mean, that last piece, like to me, I saw that and found it quite alarming because, you know, if they are conditioning their people for the normalization of the use of nuclear weapons, they're moving these nuclear weapons to Belarus. They're like hunkering down, like as if Crimea, again, is like they see it as a part of Russia.
Yeah.
The nuclear question is not like gone because they didn't use it in the first year. So that to me, of all these things that are worrisome in varying degrees, like that got my attention. Like that's not a good thing.
Yeah. The only thing that counts as good news is there was this report, I think it was in the Washington Post. There's this like an apocryphal story about Vladimir Putin. He runs into one of his old high school teachers during a visit to Israel in 2005. And after their run in, this former teacher of his said that Putin showered her with gifts and bought her an apartment. And oh, isn't he such a great guy? It turns out, based on some newly leaked documents, that the apartment was actually paid for by Roman Abramovich, a Russian oligarch connected to Putin who used to own the Chelsea soccer team. So not at all surprising, but just sort of like perfectly illustrative about how Putin operates and who he is.
And Roman Abramovich, right? Like, yeah. Like, because, you know, Putin's full of shit, but, you know, we've all seen him, like, have pictures with, like, fake people. Remember the same five people dressed in different outfits? Like, yeah. One day they were teachers and the next day they were, right. Like, you know, scientists.
Sloppy
or something.
Propaganda.
And, yeah. But the Roman Abramovich, like, spent a lot of time trying to say, like, oh, you know, I'm not that close to Putin anymore. You know, like, that was way, way back in the day, you know, when I was in Russian politics in the early 2000s. Like, now, if Roman Abramovich is, like, putting up teachers and paying for Putin's propaganda, like, that guy should be on the sanctions list, you know. He's on the right place
there.
A
couple more quick things. So Montenegro has a new president. So Jakov Milatovic is 37 years old. He briefly served as Montenegro's economy minister and is the deputy head of the Europe Now movement. This is actually a huge change for Montenegro because the incumbent president, Milo Djukanovic, has basically been president or prime minister since 1991 with a couple breaks here and there. He's basically in power the whole time. So as always, you know, these Balkan politics are complicated. Milutovic has pledged to bring Montenegro into the EU during his first term. But during the campaign, he received support from parties with links to Russia, Serbia, and the Orthodox Church, which have been hostile to the EU and to NATO. Dukanovic led Montenegro when it gained independence from Serbia in 2006 and brought them into NATO in 2017, despite objections from the Russians. For those unfamiliar, Montenegro is just a tiny little country. It's like 600,000 people on the Adriatic Sea. It's between Bosnia, Albania, Serbia, and Kosovo. But Ben, any thoughts on this big change for a little country?
I mean, like, I think the Balkan neighborhood's been a little unsteady, like, politically in recent years. And I mean, look, I think, you know, having one person dominant for that long is not healthy. So transitions of power, I think, are important. I think the question is, like, you want to see the continued European orientation. And so the hope is that, like, a different person also carries, if you see multiple leaders of different politics continuing to pursue integration with Europe and, you know, good relations with neighbors, that's a healthy sign of a, you know, maturing democracy. Like, if there's backsliding and like corruption and instability, like, that, you know, that's the kind of trend that, like, we've seen in other Balkan countries, like, pull things backwards. So I think TBD is, I think you teed it up well, like, the jury's out here. Transfer power, like, generally a good thing in democracies, but the question is, like, let's see where that goes.
Yeah, let's see where that goes. Quick little segment here called We Know Whose Side You're On. The first piece of this is OPEC Plus, which is the cartel of oil-producing countries led by Saudi Arabia. They announced a cut in oil production, sending prices up about 5% over the weekend. Second, Ben, we learned that our old buddy Jared Kushner, former Trump aide slash son-in-law, he has a private equity fund that received an investment of more than $200 million from the United Arab Emirates Sovereign Wealth Fund and a similarly sized investment from an entity linked to Qatar. So those funds from the UAE and Qatar come on top of a $2 billion investment into Kushner's investment company, private equity company from Saudi Arabia that we've known about for a while. And then before that, a Qatari-linked company bailed out Jared's property on Fifth Avenue that was deep in debt during the Trump administration. So for those keeping score at home, I think this OPEC production cut is mostly about just, like, maximizing profits and making money after a dip in energy prices. But it's a nice little side benefit for the Saudis to know that it hurts Joe Biden and it helps Russia bring in cash to fund their war. And we know these Gulf countries are pouring money into Jared Kushner's pocket, either for favors received in the past or for favors they hope to get in the future. So we know which side you're on.
You don't think they just are looking out at the whole world and thinking, like, the best person to put my money with is market genius Jared Kushner?
Yeah, this guy's got the track record. He knows the lay of the land. He's going to 10X this.
Savvy guy. I mean, it bears repeating that essentially if your interest, and this is the Saudi interest and the Emirati interest, right? If your interest in the world is autocracy succeeding and being democracy proof, fossil fuels continuing to bring in the money, and the Trump family, I don't think there's anything that, like, the U.S. foreign policy can do to make you, like, nice to us. Like, again, like, all the most of whom are on the payroll somehow of the Gulf, all the people, the analysts who think there's some mix of U.S. policies they're going to make, like, MBS join our team, like, maybe need to take a look at what the actual interests of these families are that run these countries and their oil companies and their sovereign wealth funds.
Yeah, I don't know if you saw this, but one of the big Saudi investment entities, it's called Sanibel Investments, released the list of direct investments into companies and also into private equity funds. And it's, like, a lot of the most annoying VCs in Silicon Valley, like Andreessen Horowitz, you know, like these VCs, like, yeah. Mark Andreessen, who are out there, like, whining on Twitter all day long about Joe Biden and the SVB and the Silicon Valley Bank, et cetera. So, you know, it's just good to know who's funding these people.
Just amoral guys, you know, like, and they're all guys. You're, like, just, like, the most amoral VC type guys, the kind of guys who have, like, podcasts where they talk about, like, genocide being below their line, you know?
Uh-huh.
Like,
yep. Yeah. That's the kind of crew. So Ben, two more things. As our royal correspondent, I am eager to hear your views on President Biden's reported decision to skip the coronation of King Charles III. This is apparently in the news. I'm not sure why. given that President Biden went to Queen Elizabeth's funeral last year, and no president has apparently ever attended the coronation of a British sovereign since 1776. But it seems likely we will get a round of kind of wither the US-UK special relationship stories, even if Biden sends a delegation that includes his wife, Dr. Jill Biden, the First Lady. But your thoughts on this snub?
Yeah, I would have been pretty shocked if Joe Biden went to the coronation. I don't think I don't read much into it, except like you can feel how much like the press, whether it's in the UK or in the US or anywhere, wants to write the like Charles has diminished the monarchy story.
You know,
like
that's true.
Like, that to me is headline. Like anything that happens, you know, it's going to be like, oh, you know, like Charles is not Elizabeth. You know, just this guy's got like a pretty high bar that he's not going to be able to clear. So like if I'm Charles, I'm trying to think about like how to not like have people hold me to the standard of like what they did for my mother, they're doing for me, because it's not going to happen. And so you got to set expectations here.
That's a really good point. Final story. Here's a headline from Semaphore. Mussolini's granddaughter chugged wine at 11 a.m. to protest health warnings on wine bottles. So very fascists and their kids are very hot right now. So this is a European Parliament member, Alessandra Mussolini. She took a couple of slugs of wine straight from the bottle at a press conference to protest Ireland's plan to add health warnings to wine bottles. These warnings will just include basic information about diseases linked to alcohol. Seems like a good idea. Spain and Italy are apparently whining about this plan. I personally support wine consumption at all hours. I hope you do too, since you're in France right now. But do we think this label is going to slow people down? I don't know. And did you know, Ben, that Alessandra Mussolini was an actress, that her aunt is Sophia Loren, and that she recorded a pop album that was only released in Japan? Thank you, Semaphore, for all this news.
I didn't know any of that. That's some pretty good content. That's a pretty good like niche Semaphore has carved out there. Like, and I mean that sincerely. That's good stuff. I love that she just owns the name. You know, like it does kind of show you, like, the Mussolini kind of not being in like the worst dictator club thing has always been kind of weird to me, because if you read the history, like, pretty bad guy, like about you know, like kind of like a front runner for Hitler, you know, like testing the waters, you know. So it's kind of weird, like if there was some woman named Hitler in German politics, like slugging beer at 11 a.m. in the morning, like that'd be pretty weird.
Yeah, it wouldn't play
I don't, as someone who's in France drinking a lot of wine, have for after this podcast recording a Chateau Neuf de Pop
that
I was able to pick up at half the price as in the US. This was 25 euros.
Do we still have huge tariffs on French imports of wine
in
particular?
Yes, we do. So,
why
do like
we get rid of those?
It's wine that is phenomenally expensive in the US. It's like not like crazy here. So I will be indulging in that. Like, I don't know why. It's not like the label is like one of the smoking labels where they show you some like really awful, horrific thing.
Yeah.
We're just talking about like, you know, hey, like, be careful. Like, you shouldn't drink if these things happen, or, you know, you have these conditions, right? So I don't have a problem drinking at 11 o'clock, nor do I have a problem with the labels. And I frankly, the Irish, like, it's not like that, you know, like they're not like abstaining from alcohol across the board either here. Like, they're just trying to, like, you know, let people know what's up.
Yeah, it's very strange. By the way, so I've mentioned before, Hannah's younger sister, Melanie's boyfriend, Raphael, is from Strasbourg. And we went and visited him. We drove around Provence. We drove around Chateau Neuf de Pop, actually. And it's just really fun to say. So I highly recommend
drinking. I just like saying it. That's why.
It's just fun. But you're right. Stuff over there costs like $15.
It's much less.
Like the best bottle you get.
Yeah, like the good stuff over here is like, it's just a lot less. And then the markup in an LA restaurant, forget it. You know?
Oh my God.
You're paying like $90 for something you're picking up for 20 euro in a store here.
Yeah, just sort of like house wine out of a cask over in France. Okay, that is it for us today. We don't have a guest because we're doing different time zones. Everybody's busy. Leave us alone. But don't forget to follow us at Crooked Media on Instagram, Twitter, and TikTok. Now, we're still on TikTok, even though the UK just fined them $16 million for allowing over a million kids under 13 to use TikTok back in 2020. In violation of its own rules. We'll see if they get banned over here in the US. But also, subscribe to Pod Save the World on YouTube for access to full episodes and other exclusive content. And give us a review, please. It helps everyone find the show.
you get like this background. If you watch us on YouTube, you get this like, yeah. It's like kind of like a, I mean, like an annex, like a closet to this yeah. room. So yeah.
Ben's in a closet. I would describe the pattern as sort of waiting room couch.
Yeah. Yeah, but French, with like a little French flair, you know, there's
a little
like
French
a,
flair. Yeah.
It's like a pre-revolutionary vibe to it. You know.
Yeah, that's nice. It's
like
very nice.
Indulgent.
I've been reading this book about it's a biography of Voltaire. There's sort of like a famous 17th yeah. French thinker in the 1700s. And man, French Catholics were not nice to my Protestant people back in the day. Not a good time to be a
Huguenot. Huguenots. Yeah. Yeah. You don't want to be a Huguenot.
He had it rough.
Yeah, didn't end well for those guys. Yeah.
We got fucked up. All right. Well, it's like 11 o'clock where you are, 11:05 p.m. So Ben's working late hours for you people. So thank you for listening. Thanks, Ben, for joining. And thanks, Donald Trump, for getting indicted.
Yeah. Thanks. Thanks for that. That made the day a little bit better.
Excellent. Talk to you guys soon. Pod Save the World is a Crooked Media production. Our executive producers are me, Tommy Vitor, Ben Rhodes, and Michael Martinez. Our producer is Haley Muse. Our associate producer is Ashley Mizuo. It's mixed and edited by Andrew Chadwick, Kyle Seglin, Charlotte Landis, and Vasilis Futopoulos are our sound engineers. Thanks to our digital team, Elijah Cohn, Phoebe Bradford, and Milo Kim, who upload our episodes and videos to YouTube every week. And check out the Pod Save the World YouTube account. Thanks to Saul Rubin for production support.
Hi, my name is Mitch Landrieu.
My name is Erin Haynes.
My name is Jennifer Palmieri, and we're hosting a new series called Long Play. The South is the new political epicenter of the country. Democrats are way on their heels in this region, but Republicans are going through their own reckoning in the South, too.
I mean, the South has always shaped American politics. We know that.
The stakes could not be higher, but to win the South, you have to understand it.
People in the South feel really misunderstood, left behind, put down on, and they want to explain that to somebody.
We're traveling across six Southern states to explore the people, the issues, the assumptions that no longer hold, and what the rest of us are missing about a region that will shape the future of our politics and our country. From Left, Right, and Crooked Media, starting July 27th, watch Long Play series on YouTube at youtube.com/longplayseries or listen wherever you get your podcasts.